Welcome to the Vietnamese podcast. Today I have Chris Tran from Chris Tran Travels back on. Welcome to the podcast once again, Chris.
Always a pleasure, Ken. Thank you for having me back.
I feel like you and I should be talking every week because the topics that you are covering in this last few months become such a part of every Vietnamese person's journey, historical journey in the world. Mm-hmm. And the latest one that you did with a woman who broke down Sela. Sort of our...
Yeah.
Sela.
Mm-hmm.
Her past Sela. History with Cambodia is fascinating. And I want to see more of that and I want to see deeper. And then I go to other things that you're breaking down words and I'm like, we need to see more of that. It's just never ending, Chris, and I love it so much. We should be talking once a week, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, it's never ending because, you know...
It is never ending.
Because, you know, you inspire me with the people that you have on, and then I'm getting little, like, sparks that send me on this rabbit hole, you know, and then I uncovered new things that I'm like, I never knew this, and then it just keeps going and going and going. More questions, more people, more places, and it's never ending. Like you said, it's this infinite like treasure chest of content, you know, like for us to talk about, but like personal for us. I know it's personal for you. It's just like this personal drive mm-hmm. to just keep digging. I'm never satisfied with like, oh, this is what being Vietnamese mm-hmm. is. This is it. I'm like, wait, no, there's more. Open that door. And then there's another huge rabbit hole to jump into. So that's what I'm doing. And that's what you're doing.
Do you think we will ever be satisfied with the information that we're uncovering?
We just need to sleep. We just need to get sleep. It's like, okay, I need to just, you know, like recharge my brain and then I'm back into it, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think it's ever going to end.
You know, it's
not. And that's the beautiful thing about it because, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many ways to look at being Vietnamese, being our history, our culture. Dude, I went down a huge rabbit hole with our food. Mm-hmm. I had the incredible privilege of co-hosting a Brown University study abroad course, like just recently. It's 14 students from Brown that came to Vietnam for a 3-week trip from Hanoi all the way to Mekong Delta. Big shout out to Go Jang, the Vietnamese professor who organized that and invited me on. And I came as like, they called me like the on-site liaison, you know, like they're mm-hmm. like, what do we call Chris? But I was just like connecting all these people I know from Hanoi into the Mekong Delta, like my entire network who I thought would be inspiring to the students. But then Go Jang also brought on like university professors, you know, and I'm just in the back yeah. during these lectures, like just soaking it in. And I'm like, oh my God, this is food I've been eating my whole life. No yeah. one ever thought about like, where does this come from? What about this ingredient? Like, where does the Vietnamese end and a new kind of, you know, category begin? You know, it's all gets blurrier and blurrier. And then we have to kind of like redefine it, you know, think about where we're looking at it and be like, oh, wait, I'd never caught this before. And that just keeps going. I think I can speak for the both of us that it's incredibly fulfilling. You know, it drives us.
Yeah.
And we can make that funny. We can make that yeah. emotional. We can make that, you know, personal. Like there's just so many things we can do with that. It's just beautiful.
I've been working, my day job in the last year is working with robots, cooking robots.
What? Really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
I've been in the food business for a long time. And recently I was like chomping at the bit to work for this company that my friend, Chef Nguyen, and the team is all Chinese guys from mainland China. and guys from all over China. They're just, there's just so many different types. I didn't know there's so many types of Chinese food. I just had no idea, Chris. I'm like, you know, it's like when somebody just recognizes or realizes, the Vietnamese culture, and then they jump in, and then this is what's happening to me with Chinese culture, the food culture. And then twice a week we go to lunch. The boss takes us all. We just hang out, and whoever's in the office, we go to lunch. And I began to realize, like, the difference between their noodle dishes, their food dishes, their natiu, the funk, the pungence, of some of our dishes. We have this, like, this really strong pungent. Yeah. And then when I was watching that episode with you and Sayla, right? That's her name?
Sayla,
And thinking about the Khmer roots, and when I think about Hutiu, and when I think about, like, that feeling of that pungent, that real deep kick, that fermented kick, I feel like it's, like, related to Cambodia, Laos, Thailand.
Yeah, and people.
And Cham. Yeah. And Central. Because when I eat Chinese food, a lot of Chinese food, when you eat, like, a lot of Chinese food, like a year of it, you begin to see, like, it's missing that kick.
Yeah.
That real deep, pungent kick that's in, like, Cambodian food, Lao, Thai food, that shrimpy sort of, like, it's that's sort of, like, for me now, like, the difference, the general difference, there's a different type of, like, kick that Chinese food has, but it's not that, like, and it just, there's a soul, a spirit to that kind of, food that, I'm beginning to notice the difference between just in general.
That's awesome. That's awesome that you noticed that. Cause then now I'm looking at the food really differently too, after learning about it and the history of it. And, you know, when I talk about it, it seems like a lot of people in the comments get really emotional about, like, who does it belong to, you know, like, who started it. And then you can dig, like, deep, deep, deep into that. And I think even the scholars that are really, like, committing their lives to digging this stuff up, like, they disagree with each other, you know?
Totally.
So who are we, you know? So it's like, at the end of the day, when I'm reading these, like, really, like, charged comments, like, no, like, Vietnamese people came up with fish sauce first because it was in, like, our historical records. And it was like, it's Cham people. And it's like, oh, there's a theory that the Romans came up with it. And then it, you know, traveled on sea routes to Southeast Asia. Who cares? You know, what's actually more interesting to me, and you know, I think maybe it's the old geography teacher in me, because I used to teach geography as well in high school, is the reason for it is really interesting, because they're saying that it evolved out of this necessity for fermentation, right? To kind of preserve food in really harsh climate. And that's the central region of Vietnam. Mm. With, like, there was, like, a lack of farmland. So people were fishing a lot. There, you needed a way to ferment food. And then you get mum is, like, such a thing there. And then it's also, like, the energy people need to work. It's, like, very, very salty, super pungent, like, flavors. And spice was believed to fight off toxins. So you needed spicy food to, like, kind of survive these climates. Like, that's what people thought during that time. So the last time I went to Hue, which is about 2 weeks ago, I started to kind of notice it in the Hue food and the Da Nang food. When I ate the mum there, I'm like, whoa, this is really spicy and salty. I never really registered this, you know, but it's like, oh, it comes from this need. This survival, you know, like, people were doing it because of a very specific purpose. And it's fascinating to me that now it's like, it's just cuisine, right? It's just like, it's just Vietnamese cuisine. This is how we eat. These are the flavors. This is what Vietnamese people like, you know? But back then, I don't know, 1,000 years ago, when someone was coming up with these, it wasn't because of taste preferences or, like, some chef was like, we're just going to concoct this because it's like, this just tastes good to us. It's like, no, it was like for very specific reasons and very specific conditions that it came about. And it came about too because of what they had on hand in their environment. That's what grew our food, you know? And now it's like hip, you know, you can find it in like a hip restaurant, but it comes from like these people that were doing it to survive off of what they had, like, you know, centuries ago. To me, that's cool. It doesn't matter who it was. We can get really into that too. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, that's more fascinating to me. Yeah. So,
and then it, as you're telling the story, this story, the last minute, I'm thinking about the restaurant in New York called Mum. Mm-hmm. And Mum relies on this pungency. It relies on this sort of like this deep umami, like oomph to, you know, it's arguably one of the best Vietnamese restaurants in the United States. This restaurant in New York, the way it's set up, the chef behind it is a white guy, you know, killing the food. It's just like
in a good way, or in a bad way.
No, great way. He's okay, just a badass. Yeah. The food there is just, I could probably eat there every day. But if you take out the pungency of what, you know, the conversation that we're talking about, it's not Mum. I mean, it's called Mum, you know, it's the restaurant's called Mum. It's the soul of our food in its own way. 'Cause when I eat Chinese food, it doesn't have that at all. You know?
Yeah.
There's almost no fish sauce, I feel like, in some parts of the dishes that I eat. The bowls of noodles is very similar to hủ tiếu. You know, it has all the little accoutrements, but it doesn't have that stink, you know, that cool, like,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, that punch, that slap that in the face. Yeah.
That slap in the face, yeah. That really separates our cuisine. And I feel like, you know, psychologically, it bleeds into, like when you talk about the spice and, you know, the flavors of the central dishes, it affects, you know, psychologically affects the way I see the culture of the central people, right? They're just... Yeah. There's a difference sort of like in the way that they kind of like carry themselves. But it's psychological to me, you know, I'm not saying that there's any empirical thing that I can research, you know, it's just a feeling I get.
You're not the only one. I mean, I've noticed that, and I confirmed it with even these professors who said, like, you know, they all agree there is kind of a connection between, what's available to people, how they eat, and the culture. Because they talked about how that transformed when it got to the Mekong Delta, when Vietnamese skin settlers were moving into the Mekong Delta, and it was a land of abundance. There was so much available in the natural environment. Like, they didn't really need to really even farm. You can just stick your hand in the water and catch a fish. There was like all these like, you know, plants all around. And so people could just like grab a bunch of stuff, wrap it up in some like rice paper, and then just eat, you know? So it was just like very, very generous. Like the environment was just very generous to them, you know, so much abundance, very different from the central where you had to survive, right? You had to preserve food. You had to use a lot of mum to kind of like, you know, have food that you might not get later, you know, 'cause they have 4 months of typhoons in central, right? And in the South, they didn't really have to worry about that. And like, does it make the people the way they are? I think there's kind of a connection. I'm just going to like put that theory out there that, you know, Ming Tai people are very generous. They're very open. You know, they're very like welcoming. You know, the food is like just from one edge of the table to the other, you know, and these huge like baskets of herbs. And like, you know, that's just how they eat. It's how they are as people. Just come in my house, drink all my beer. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're welcome to it, all of it, you know? And I think it's kind of cool when we make these connections. We could be wrong, but like, how fascinating is that? You know, that the food led to the culture, the people. And like, sometimes the food was like really just like what these settlers were, you know, eating, because that's what they had on hand in their environment. And like, I don't think, you know, 16th, 15th century settler during that time was thinking that, you know, this food's going to make it into a New York restaurant, like, you know, generations later. Like, how crazy is that? You know, I just love that stuff.
The transformation of who we become and how we affect people who are not in our culture, like mom and being in New York, and you see all of these international travelers in this restaurant and how it's like really reverberating and creating such a beautiful connection for Vietnamese people to the outside world. You know, there needs to be an encyclopedia type historical documenting of Vietnamese food, because I think that there's just like the Chinese cuisine, there are hundreds and hundreds of dishes that we do not know about. Exactly. Nobody can just know about all of these dishes in Vietnam. And the variations of some certain dishes. Because the more you dig into the Vietnamese cuisine, it's not what we think it is. There's a depth to it and variations to things and why things are different in certain regions. Not all pho is the same. Not all bánh xèo is the same. Yeah. Not all heo quai is the same. You know, it's a really rich place.
Yeah, yeah. And all these dishes, there's a timeline, right, of when these dishes came about, because, okay, on top of it just being what was available to them, it was also interaction with other cultures. Like, we wouldn't have banh mi if the French weren't there, right? We wouldn't have maybe even, people might attack me in the comments for this, but maybe even noodles without, you know, Northerners coming in from China, right?
Oh, I thought you meant French and noodles. Just to clarify, everybody.
But it's like, you know, when we say like Vietnamese cuisine, we're thinking like this box, you know, but me, like in my head, it's like, especially now, it's like a Venn diagram, you know, there's all these like overlapping, like, you know, circles on top of each other. And it's like, here's Khmer cuisine, here's French cuisine, here's Chinese cuisine, but like different regions of China or whatever, here's Laotian cuisine. And it's like overlapping. And even those categories, you can like, you know, dissect them even further and then break them up even more, you know, so it just keeps going and going and going. And it's just like us putting labels on stuff to make things easier for our brains. But like, it's such like this beautiful, chaotic mess is cuisine and culture and our language and like all of it, you know. That's why this exploration doesn't stop, you know, because it's like we're just lifting more layers off of it, and it's just like, oh cool, like this came about because of this, and you know, add a little of this and a little of that. It's mind-blowing.
I'm gonna put this out there in the comment section. I'm asking anybody who's listening or watching this today, that if they know of other things about people who are like real like researchers and people who talk about this, please leave it in the comments, because Chris and I will definitely explore this more. And the reason I ask that is because I'm thinking about a mutual friend that you and I have, who I consider a national treasure to Vietnam, both Vietnamese Americans and Vietnamese in Vietnam.
I know who you're about to talk about.
Go for it.
Are you talking about Daniel?
Yeah. There's only, why is there only that one guy that we both think about? He's truly a national treasure to the people of Vietnam all over the world. And I, you know, you and I are the mouthpieces, but he's like in the trenches researching in the forest and, you know, done the work the last 20 years. And such a fascinating, fascinating soul.
Because I'm going to be straight up honest here. When I met Daniel, so this was on that food trip, this like food study course that I was.
Wait, you just met Daniel?
Yeah, I just met Daniel. So
how is that possible that you just met Daniel, that you've been there for so long and doing the same?
I just met him because on the travel study course, one of the students sent a message in the group chat and it was like, oh, I've heard about Songkai. They're really amazing. Like, I really like what they do. And then that's when I finally checked them out. Cause I don't drink a lot. I'm not a gin drinker either, yeah. especially. Mm-hmm. So then I was like, I don't know about them. I feel like I've heard of them. And then I looked at their website and I was like, okay, this is really cool. Just like the 5 minutes that I like looked at it, I was like, okay, this is amazing. I will go with you. It's off of the itinerary. So the school doesn't pay for this part, you know? So if you go, I'll go with you. So we had a little group that went and I was like talking to some guy's Instagram account, not knowing it was Daniel, right? So he's like, come on through and I'll take you guys around like the distillery and I'll you know, show you guys what we do. And I was like, awesome. So we showed up, there was like six of us. It was awesome that the students who asked to go really knew so much. They asked a million questions. They were like genuinely curious and knew about distilling and spirits and all this. I was like just this spectator, you know, like listening to this like nonstop, like 4 hour conversation about distilling. And like hearing Daniel talk about his history, his background, how long he's been there. And it just clicked. I'm like, okay, I see what kind of person Daniel is. You know, like what kind of Vietnamese diaspora on their journey to Vietnam type of person he is. You know, I put him in a different category. You know, I put him in a different category because... And then I hate to do this, but like, you know, I kind of place Vietnamese diaspora that comes to Vietnam and I'm just like, okay, this person is like a new seeker. They're fresh. You know, they're like here because they're curious about Vietnam. They're trying to find themselves, you know, like they never spoke a lot of Vietnamese back home. And like, you know, they've only been to Vietnam with family. Cool. That's the path that you're on. Right now. That's awesome. Welcome. You know,
right.
Daniel is a different category. He's like a different, like he's way beyond that. He might like get cravings for burgers and like want to speak a little more English a certain day, but he's like deep into the entire Vietnamese world and like the culinary world, the history. Like he's just like you said, he's a national treasure.
He's a national treasure.
Vietnamese people in general, you know, because of his work and his depth of knowledge and his passion and his connection to local communities and what he's doing. I haven't met
anybody at that academic level, like a PhD wouldn't even, you know, it wouldn't even be suffice to describe Daniel. It's almost like on a spiritual, like cloud, like he's sitting on a spiritual cloud realm, yeah. You know, like a God, you know,
he's like God, like there's no distinction now between Daniel and like what he's doing anymore.
He's an absolute G. And not G for gangster, but G for genius, you know, he's a total G. And, you know, it's like funny that you bring up the whole craving for burgers. He was in LA one time and Chef Nguyen and I were hanging out and, you know, we were coordinating to hang out with him. He, you know, Chef Nguyen is like knows all the little spots and the Michelin spots, the street spots, the taco spots everywhere in LA. And then, it was crazy being around these two guys. They were like, where are we getting dinner tonight? And they're like, chicken neck tacos in East LA or somewhere. And we go to this place that's, look, I come from LA. I was like basically born and raised in LA. I've never heard of this spot. And you go there and it's like packed. And it's been going on for years. It's packed. This chicken neck taco heard place. Of this dish. And you're from LA too, Chris. I've never heard of it either. Tacos? Chicken neck tacos.
Okay.
It is insane. It was, but I'm just saying, this is like one of the many arrows that these guys have in their quiver. You know, but Chef Wayne is like food. And then Daniel's like, they're like both these like black belts in food. And you just watch them on the mat and they're just like mind blowing to see the depth.
I don't even need to eat. It's like, you got to talk about it. Break this down for me. Explain it.
Hear about it. Yeah.
Why you're into this.
It's insane. And then they're like doing this about, because, you know, these guys are traveling all over the world, like Germany, and they're like talking about like how they crave. So, and they're not like flexing. They're just like truly like two souls who are like just that buzzing, connecting when they're together, you know?
I love being around it, that.
Yeah, it's, I feel like that around you, you know, like we get to like nerd out on the culture and and be,
we don't sleep. Like, that's why I brought that up, because we're staying up to like 4 a.m. when I see you talking about this stuff. It's like, Ken, we got to go to bed, man. It just keeps going. Yeah. But you know, same to you, man.
Who else in the world, you know, and I'm not obviously asking you that right now, but I would love to hear it in the comments. Who else in the world, can Chris and I, you know, talk to more, or should be on our radar, because 2 years ago you should have known about Daniel, and now you're knowing about, you know what I mean? Like, that's, but you're in the thick of it. You're in Vietnam and you're around that world, and now you're just now meeting. So imagine if, that's why I always say we need more podcasters. We just need more. We need like 100x more podcasters doing what we do.
I mean, sometimes I'm too in the thick of it that, like, you know, like sometimes I'm in like a village in central Vietnam trying to help them build a bridge, you know? And so I'm not tapped into like who's doing what, who's talking about what. But when I do, like, I love just, you know, being around that. Like Daniel, like, oh my God. Yeah. He's just like a treasure trove. I'm asking the same thing.
Yeah.
Who's out there? Who's doing this? So I invited a couple friends onto like this food course that we did. I don't know if you ever had Leela on. Leela's amazing. Curious about Vietnam.
I've never been heard of that. Who is Leela?
There you go. Yeah. So Leela, Vietnamese name is V. She does a page called Curious About Vietnam. She's also called Miss Yummy Face. But... she's so, oh my God, what do I call her? She's like a Vietnamese food ambassador. She's like, because she's like very bilingual, she does all her content in English, but you know, she's from Vietnam. She's from Hat Tinh, like North Central Vietnam. Amazing journey, but I just love how she has this like kind of like insider connection to vendors, to chefs, to people who grow the food, you know, like it's a very intimate, very deep understanding of street food, Vietnamese, just food culture, which I really appreciate. So when I brought her along, she made a little speech with the students. They loved it. They loved it. We have another guest speaker.
I had to like lower the volume. Sorry about that, everybody.
Yeah.
But go on.
Just dropping that name for you right there. My really good friend. She's incredible. But I feel like there's gotta be so many people out there. People in the comments, please let us know. I really want to find more of these, you know, seekers, people who are like very deep into it, who are doing incredible things right now. I just want to learn from them. Yeah, just kind of be around that curiosity, that passion.
You know, I sent you topics that we're going to talk about, because I've been thinking a lot about these topics. And every time I see your clips, I think about, you know, these other things that are not food related. So we're moving into the second half of our conversation, and I want to touch on some of these ideas. I feel like Vietnam is striving towards cleaning up, to clear out corruption, bribery, shenanigans, and they're really going hard in the paint. You know, like Vietnam is really trying to do some, but it's slowing down the economy, because you got to kind of like, you have to go really slow in order to go really fast. I think there's targets in 2045 for Vietnam to be like
developed,
like
country.
Trying to be, say again, developed country. It's
like developed country status by 2045,
you know, right? Which is insane if you think about it. You know, it's like that's a huge,
very huge jump.
Huge jump. That's like, you know, but you could see that it's happening. And, you know, people in the States, Vietnamese people, they don't believe it. They don't understand it. They don't, you know, really kind of. So I wanted to ask you, what are you seeing on the ground as somebody who lives there and who could kind of like make this distinction of like, is life really improving in the way that it should be? Damn, that's a charged question, but
that's really hard question for me to answer. I don't think I'm equipped to answer it. I would say, like, you know, just there's challenges. I know that Vietnam knows there's challenges because they're doing a lot. You know, it's just that's all I could say. Like, for example, when I went to Hanoi with these students recently, it was the first time I experienced the them getting rid of the sidewalk businesses. So like a lot of our favorite JF places and street places, they used to just spill out into the sidewalk. That was like their business for however long. And then it's just like all empty, you know? So we went to our favorite JF place that used to be packed, right? Damn. And now they have to operate just within their house because they can't be on the sidewalk anymore. And then Hanoi itself was just like kind of dusty because there's all this construction that was going on because they're just like rebuilding Hanoi pretty much, right? It's this massive amount of development that's going on, like just, you know, making a new city, it seems like. Yeah. And then, you know, with the new airport that's going to come in, around Ho Chi Minh City, them building like a track, a new like high speed rail through Gung Ye, which a lot of people are saying are like kind of like the last kind of big green zone around Saigon. So they're going to build a high speed rail there to like some like luxury development that's going on the coast. Yeah, just all these big things. I can't comment on it. Like, you know, you need to hit up our boy Mike Tatarski or someone who's really tapped into a lot of the economic policies right now. But on the ground, I would say, man, I guess I'm a unique person to ask because my work takes me to a lot of different communities. I go to a lot of kind of rural communities, Central Vietnam, Mekong Delta, where it hasn't trickled down to them as fast. You know, I'm not saying the government doesn't care about them. I know that
it's a natural thing. Can't trickle down that.
It can't trickle down penetrate. That fast.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, they have to prioritize
policy,
things.
Yeah.
They can't do everything at once.
This episode is brought to you by Red Boat Fish Sauce. Some things will never be replicated by AI. The fragrance of fish sauce hitting a hot pan. The sound of your grandmother's voice telling a story only she knows. The feeling of a family recipe passed down through generations that are imperfect, alive, and completely real. Red Boat Fish Sauce has been a proud sponsor of the Vietnamese podcast for years because, like us, they believe in authenticity you can taste. And together, we're bringing you the Viet Story Bank, a recording service built on that same belief. Your stories matter. Your family's memories, your lived experiences, your history. These deserve to be preserved exactly as they are. Untouched, unfiltered, they're human. So don't wait for the right moment. Learn more about the Viet Story Bank through the link in our show notes and pick up a bottle of fish sauce at H Mart, 99 Ranch, or redboatfishsauce.com.
But yeah, it's still pretty rough for them in some of the parts where I'm at. I will say that there was one really big project that we were doing in the central region in what used to be Hoang Nam province. We were renovating like a huge road that last year, because of the typhoons, was like just demolished and it kind of isolated this village, right? So then they were kind of stuck out there. It was really hard to evacuate people and, you know, they were kind of cut off. So then we fundraised to help them kind of like reinforce this road that connected the village. And the government has stepped in to, you know, just redo the whole thing. And that just happened recently. Like we were just scrambling to like kind of reinforce it with like rocks and stuff like that, you know, big rocks. And that was kind of the game plan. And then when I went back to visit maybe a few months ago, they were like, oh, the government stepped in now. And now, you know, they're contributing this much money and they're just going to redo the whole thing. And then in the same village, we were trying to build a playground for the school, this like kindergarten. And then they're like, oh, the kindergarten's not there anymore. I was like, what? What happened? They're like, they just demolished it and they're going to build a new one. So I just came back there to visit it. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay. It's like another kindergarten, double the size. Right. So it's happening. Yeah. It's like, you know, all around, it might not be reaching obviously all the communities. Like you said, it cannot trickle down, cannot be developing all at once at every location. But yeah, they're pulling off like a lot of things right now. It's going to be a different Vietnam, I feel, soon.
Yeah, it's hopeful, but at the same time, a little bit sad because the magic of the street vendors and our lives of the citizens that have these magical businesses that spill out into the road, into the street that we get to experience as travelers or foreigners. And the magic of Vietnam needs to be cleaned up to make way for, you know, a cleaner, tidier sort of systematic way of fitting into this developed pattern of a developed nation.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, what's the balance? You know, how do you do that to kind of take care of people, keep that essence, you know, because I think I hear this not just from like tourists and like visitors who are romanticizing this, like locals feel this way too. You know, they do feel like this is what Vietnam has always been. You know, what is Hanoi? What is Ho Chi Minh City without the street vendors and, you know, the street culture, the ladies selling like bánh tráng chấu by like Ho Kong Rùa, you know, like, which are not there anymore. Right. They're not there either. And so it is cleaning up. And now I'm hearing like also they're really formalizing all the taxes as well. So, you know, you had like a lot of Vietnam's economy being kind of like an informal economy. And now it's just they're just, you know, organizing all of that. And people are going to have to register their businesses and pay taxes and probably have inspectors check out what they're doing, you know? Again, disclaimer, I don't know the actual policies right now, but yeah, on the ground, it's very visibly changing. It's always been visibly changing. Yeah, like, you know, like how fast the development has been in Vietnam and the change. And like now it's like going even faster because, you know, the policies are massive, you know, how they're revamping everything.
And I'm sure every society in known to mankind has had to undergo this transformation. Mm-hmm. And in some ways it's beautiful for some people. And, you know, it's absolutely destroying other, you know, communities of people. When we think about how it's every time there's a shift, it's got to be good for some people and horrible for other people.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like, you know, me being on the ground working with community programs and you know, folks out in like very rural parts, small towns, things like that. You know, I think about them a lot. You know, I just think about like if these big changes happen, and they will, that there are programs in place, there's things to support them that, you know, they're going to find. They're going to share in the whatever, you know, success that Vietnam hopes to achieve. Like, you know, this, it's going to like trickle down to folks here. And my mom, you know, she visited recently.
That was like the next topic that I was getting into. I was going to transition right into your mom right now. Crazy.
Yeah, like it was beautiful because I got to bring her to all these community projects, you know, all the way out in central Vietnam. We went to this place I was talking about where we're doing this infrastructure work in near Hoi An. I brought her out to the Mekong Delta and she met these people. And like, she has a different perspective, you know, where she's just like, they're doing so much better than we were doing back in our day, you know? Wow. Like, that's like kind of where she's coming from, because she's seeing people like they have motorbikes, you know, they're able to get around. They have plenty of food, you know, they have housing, like, you know, like they seem really happy, you know. She's not seeing a lot of struggle in average families in these rural areas, even, you know. I think me being in Saigon, like I'm seeing like this fast development, these huge high rises, you know, yachts even.
Yeah.
And it's just like the gap is just so massive. But then, you know, she kind of was like seeing how, you know, people have enough and compared to what she was seeing back in like the 70s, you know, the early 80s, she's like, yeah, this is good. You know, people are doing well and I hope they do better. Of course, that's not a comprehensive view of how people are doing in Vietnam, but like, you know, it was interesting that my mom shared that perspective.
You know, your mom has three kids, right?
Yeah.
Now she lives in the States, but two of her kids are in Vietnam, right?
Yes, two of her boys are in Vietnam.
Two of her boys are in Vietnam. Yeah.
And her baby, my little brother, he's a lot younger than.
And why, you know, this is, my mom would never move to Vietnam. And why is your mom living in the States when two of her kids are in Vietnam? And
grandma.
Oh.
Yeah. She's like, it's the daughter's duty. It is the child's duty, you know? And like, we're not talking her out of it. You know, it's just like, you should take care of grandma, mom. Like that's what.
Does your mom, I ask this because, you know, I live with this and I contend with this, with a lot of older people in their generation that they don't want to live in Vietnam. And it just boggles my mind. I'm like, you can live in Vietnam and have it's a very biased view. You can have a much better life. Why would you want to be outside of Vietnam and you can live inside of Vietnam with this structure? You have your sons and you're going into old age and you got people taking care. But I know it sounds like your mom has grandma, but I'm asking this as a general question. Like, one day is your mom open to like living in Vietnam? Did she, you guys talk about that?
She said that she wants to be here.
Yeah.
That's huge for us. Massive for me. 20 years, man, back and forth, you know, ever since I've fallen in love with Vietnam and like just finding my place, like my community here and committing to this place and my parents being like, what are you doing? You know? And then to hear my mom say like, I want to join you guys. I really want to be there. You know, and she was so sad to leave a couple of days ago. And it was like, man, it was very emotional for us. And it was beautiful, man. The 3 weeks that she was here and, you know, and, you know, I think like 80% of it was just us being together, but then for her to have healed and to enjoy being here and like, you know, allowing herself to just really have a good time with us was amazing. It was the first time that it was like that for us, you know, and I felt like she had no issues with like the idea of her moving back here. Like she really wants to, but she has that obligation. So like, I think that, you know, we're going to see a lot more visits, you know? But the question that you asked, why wouldn't you choose this life? That's totally really a question that I asked my dad, actually.
Yeah. It's like, what? But
because he has all the means and no responsibilities.
I can never claim to fully understand what they went through. I can't. It's like if I ever move to Vietnam and my kids are like, dude, why would you leave LA? Why would you leave the place that we all grew up in and we had such a good time riding the subway together, going to little Tokyo together with each other and eating all these wonderful variations of food? Why, Dad, why would you not live in LA? And that's the question I asked my mom and all of my uncles who can, you know, who have money. Oh, she's actually had like two brothers who actually moved back to Vietnam permanently. So I'm like, all right, there's guys that do this. Yeah. But for the most part, why would you not want to be with your sons and relocate to a place that people look like you, talk like you, you know, life is not that difficult. It's a wonderful place. Yeah. You know?
I wonder that a lot, actually. Okay. Well, for my dad, and I'm kind of speaking for him here, he's actually very mysterious with the reasons. I don't really know why, but I'm guessing because he came back here 2 years ago and I was kind of watching him, spending a lot of time with him, but like watching his experience here. And it was really awkward for him. It's really tough for him navigating Vietnam and like, you know, stumbling with the apps and like everything felt familiar, but the unfamiliar was like scary to him, you know, having to ask locals, like, how do you use this app? How do I pay for this? Like, you know, he felt so awkward. And then it hit me that like, he had actually spent more of his life in the States by that point than Vietnam, you know, and in the US, even though from outside, it seems like, oh, this must be so weird for you. Cause like, you know, it's not your people. You don't get to speak Vietnamese all the time. Yeah. But actually my dad's routine is like, he's set, you know, he's speaking his broken English at work still. He's got his buddies, you know, he's got, you know, where he lives and he's got his little routine. And then to break away from that and go into a place that should feel familiar to him.
Yeah.
Cause he grew up there, but it doesn't. It's like moved way past what he's familiar with. And you can hear it in the way he talks sometimes because my dad's like kind of unfiltered. And my dad's like, what the heck is this? This is terrible. Like, what? Why did they build this? I'm like, Dad, relax. You know, like, he's like criticizing everything, you know?
Yeah,
but it's like, that's his way of coping with I don't like this. This is like a lot of change for me. And it's kind of freaking me out a little bit here, you know? So that's, I think that's what he was experiencing. It's like, it's not political, you know, like I know for a lot of our first generation, our parents, you know, it's political. I think my mom and my dad, you know, have kind of thankfully moved past that trauma. So for them, it's something even deeper, you know, it's like, well, you know, my mom now it's changed, you know, because of this recent trip, but with my dad, it might be something a lot deeper than that. You know, it's psychological and for my dad too, it's a little different from a lot of our, it's a little different from a lot of my friends' parents because he's not moving back to a bunch of family members.
Yeah.
So, you know, for your mom, it's like, if she comes back here, like two of her brothers are here.
Yeah.
You know, and like a lot of my friends' parents who have moved back here, they're moving back to join massive extended family, you know, and building their little house in like Mekong Delta or whatever. Totally. They're just surrounded. Like, this is how I grew up. This is amazing. You know, like my dad doesn't have that. He left. He's Baknam Tu. He left the north when
he
was
one. No roots left. Yeah.
No roots left. So it's like, no one. Everybody's gone. So if he comes here, the crazy thing is like his family are going to be his kids.
Yeah.
And were born and grew up in the States that is Vietnam now.
Mind boggling to think about the pattern of that, right? It's like, what the? It's surreal. It's a place where you came from. Yeah. Your entire lineage is from here, but you look around and you're not related to anything except the kids that were born away from this, you know.
And craziest thing is that in a lot of ways I know more about Vietnam than him. And it feels weird to say that because obviously like he grew up in a very traumatic time and his experience and like all these things and like obviously I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about like I've traveled more than him.
Yeah. Yep.
In Vietnam, I've talked to more locals throughout Vietnam than him. I've talked to a wider spectrum of people than him, from like professors to like farmers to like celebrities to musicians to like all these kinds of people. Like my understanding of this place and the different communities is vast,
like 1,000x.
And that's what I was doing with my mom. I was like taking her to introduce her to like all these dimensions of Vietnam, these facets of Vietnam, these different communities that she didn't really know about.
Yeah.
We went to Hue and she's never been there. She asked me, like, I want to go to Hue. Can you take me? I've never been that far north before. I was like, yeah, let's go. I have friends there. You know, like, you know, I know a driver. We can like check it out. I want to introduce you to all these people. And then that's what I was doing. It felt amazing, and but kind of weird if you think about it, right? This is like I didn't grow up here, you know, and I'm showing my mom like her birth country, you know, and it's a crazy thing that's happening, you know.
But man, that's so beautiful. Yeah, that's amazing and beautiful. I can't imagine what that's like, you know. There is another thing that's related to this topic of family that I found to be so funny too. You were talking to your brother and it was like, you guys never speak Vietnamese together. And it's like, there's this awkwardness to it. You know, I cannot speak Vietnamese to my brother. It's just cringy. It's just, I don't know what it is. But to call my brother An and Em, but you know, even when I talk to
that's the weirdest thing.
When I talk to my mom about my brother, I say An Tu, right? I'll label my older brother An, and even that feels a little bit like it's a little. But and I've been doing that for like 30, 40 years of my life, you know, because my mom really made a point to correct that. You know, you just can't call your brother Tom. You know, you have to call him his Vietnamese and Dang Wang, right? Like be correct about it.
Yeah,
and I'm watching you talk about this with your brother, and it makes me realize how really far removed we are culturally on a language level that we can't even speak to our brother in our brothers in his native language.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating to me.
Fascinating.
Because the feeling is real. It's so awkward, you know? And especially the An Em, you know, like imagining your brother coming up to you be like, hôm nay em có muốn đi với anh đi ăn. You know, it's like, what did you call me? That's so weird, dude. You know, but I think it's like, it's not just the language. Like, it's not just speaking Vietnamese to each other. It's also like the ranking, you know, like I just don't see my brother as like this little em to me, you know. Like, I'd have to like get used to that. I have to train my brain to get used to that. And then he calls me my Vietnamese name too with An. It's An. My Vietnamese name is Minh. So he does call me An. Yeah, but then I feel like it's like merged into just a word, you know? It's not like a rank, you know?
But wait, is he calling you An like naturally? Like, is it okay for him or not?
He calls me An Minh, which is my Vietnamese name. And then, you know, with brother, with An. But it doesn't feel like he's saying it like it's some kind of rank, you know? Like big brother. And I'm not using am back to him. Like, to me, that's cringy. And I feel like it's cringy to him too. But yeah, it what is that? Like, why is that?
Yeah.
Like, cause you know, even my little sister, she doesn't even call me An, actually. Only my little brother does. He's 17 years younger than me. My sister is 3 years younger than me, but we've never had that culture of calling each other An and Am. She doesn't even call me An Minh. I don't have that rank with even my sister. We're just like equals, you know?
It's such a weird dynamic.
When we speak Vietnamese, it's weird.
It's weird. It's just so it's weird. Really weird. And you can't speak Vietnamese without using these pronouns.
It's like rankings.
You can't use Vietnamese. It's like it's like cooking, but you have no heat, you know. It's you have to have heat to cook. You have to have these pronouns to cook. In Vietnamese, you have to.
Interesting. Yeah, because it's like I can't do that with my mom with English. Like, I speak Vietnamese with her. And we have our own little world together that's just Vietnamese, right? Like, I don't have an English world with my mom. With my little brother, it's the opposite, right? Yeah. Like my sister, it's just like we only have this English world. Like, we've never established a Vietnamese language world with each other to talk about these things, to tell stories to each other in Vietnamese and like jokes to each other, or like share emotions in Vietnamese with each other. Yeah. You know, we're always going to opt to using English as a tool for that. And like, you know, we operate in an English world. Like, we don't have a Vietnamese toolkit for that with each other.
I just realized something. It's something that we probably think about all the time, but I just realized something. It just hit me like a ton of bricks right now. All these years of talking to my mom and dad or grownups and occasionally being really nasty or being really strong to their ears, me using certain languages, and them going home, mukyai, and it really triggered them in a way where they just wanted to smash my face in. The opposite is true of what's happening to them when they're in the States and their young American child is talking to them like not even like equals, but you're like, as an American child, you're talking literally down to your mom and dad. Like you're saying, no, let me educate you. They gonna yay by man. You don't say, let me teach you in Vietnamese. You know, you never say that. That's just unheard of, the way you use the word, let me teach you, let me educate you. That it's, you can't as a child educate back up. But in America, you can. Hey mom, let me tell you about this. You know, your ideas of like, you know, reversing the river's flow going upstream is completely normal in American society, the way we use language. It's not like disrespectful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I totally agree. I think there is kind of like this thing that's inherent in English, especially American English, that the language kind of carries the culture, and the culture is very like equalizing, right? It's very like, you know, it's very like informal. But Vietnamese is not like that. Even if you're informal with Vietnamese, and I do see Vietnamese locals talk pretty informal with their parents, they can yai their parents, but it has to be cute. It has to be a joke. It's not serious, you know? Like, there's a way to do it where it's, like, very cute. But, like, that hierarchy is established. And, you know, you still are very much, like, respectful to the parents, respectful to elders in general. You know, taking care of the people who are older than you, like it's built into the culture and into the language here. You know, like people are very careful with that. And that's not, it's not like, going back to that word toolkit again, it's not a toolkit that we have. Like that's a thing that is like very normal for Vietnamese people here. I work with a very young Gen Z local Vietnamese team, and they would just snap into like character. Like they'll just know what to do when an older person's there. When my mom is in the room, like they're just
they
like
become different. They transform.
Become different. Yeah, they transform into like a, yeah. They're very respectful. You know, they code know what switch. To do. They know how to. They just code switch. You know. So to me, that's amazing. You know, I'm not gonna be like super hard on our second and third gen who like don't have that education and that toolkit. That experience, it's not their fault, but it's very nice to see young Vietnamese folks who are taught that, who continue to carry on that culture, and that kind of like respectful, you know, way of using the language. And I like to see that. I know there's like a dark side to it where, you know, you have to like shut up and just kind of like, you know, obey orders or like, you know, sometimes that ranking kind of backfires a little bit, but it's that respect, you know, and that kind of like humbling yourself when someone's older than you. I like that. I really like that, you know, and it goes beyond language too. Like you see them snap into it when, you know, like an older person is sitting down, they'll get them a drink of water, you know, after. They eat, like the young people start to clean up, you know, or like they'll fight each other about cleaning up. Like,
yeah,
that's very Vietnamese. You know, that's been a big part of our culture, that when we're in the West, a lot of the younger generation and myself included, before I learned and watched all of this, we just sit there, you know, or it's just like we have American ways of doing things. It's like very direct, you know. Oh, you didn't ask me to do that, so I didn't do it.
It's very cringy when I'm in Vietnamese places and like homes in Vietnam or in America, it doesn't matter. And I'm with Vietnamese people, and at the end of a meal, if there are people with me that don't get up to move with the kitchen flow, men or women, it's just very cringy to me. Because that's what
see them not move?
When I see them not move, I'm like, what? Where do you come? Like, who raised you? It's such a, but I think in American homes, it's more like, this is not my house. I'm not going to get up to, you know, I'm not going to get up to clean or, you know, move the dishes. Yang kiang yo, right? But in Vietnamese homes in America and Vietnamese homes in Vietnam, if whoever I'm with is not moving, it's just a very awkward feeling. Maybe if they're a little older than me and they're like, go back or whatever, and they don't get up, that's fine. But typically, yeah, if they're my age or younger, you're like, you better get your ass up and like, yeah, moving some cups in the kitchen. And, you know, men or women, it doesn't matter to me. It's just, yeah, you need to start picking up and signaling that you understand the culture of this is community. And we don't just sit there and not move, you know?
Yeah, those, I mean, you know what? I'll take it back. You know, I'm going to get a little hard on the first generation here, or the second, third generation. They need to know good form, you know? It's taught to Vietnamese folks here, but like, I don't think anyone argues against that. It's very important in the culture to have those kind of manners. My mom goes crazy.
My mom too.
Young folks come in and they don't gow, right? That's such a big deal for my mom. Like, automatically you're in her bad books. If you're coming in all timid and shy and it's like, oh, I don't know what to call her. And I'm just going to like slip into the room. Like, if my friends came over and they did that, or my little brother's friends, boom, they're in the bad books for life. You know, like, you have to gow. Very respectful greeting.
I take it to another level because I have kids and I have to do this to them because they don't get it. Ain't even about the chow for me, dude. It's not even about that. It's chow, but you better be connecting your eyes to the person that you chow.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not enough. It's not enough to just say, ya kung chow back. Like, I have to, I make my children, like, literally, you square up shoulder to shoulder with the person and you have, mm-hmm, to look at them and be in the present moment and not, yeah, be like, go back. And then you're like looking somewhere else and you want to run. You want to get to your, yeah, toys and you want to get to the back of your room. No. You sit there because it's human connection at this point.
Human connection.
We yeah need to make sure we establish a firm connect with the person. Mm-hmm. And I think that the Vietnamese way of chow, you know, is so beautiful and warm.
Yeah.
Which but is that? It's missing. Yeah. This whole other dimension, if you're not connecting eyes, mm-hmm, and really sitting connect in that moment to connect with the eyes. So I really push this with my children, yeah, every time they are, yeah, with, yeah, and my parents did that to me. And I talked to so many Vietnamese adults that thanked their parents who did that to them when they were growing up in America, because, you know, it really makes a huge difference in how you carry entire conversations with people in Vietnamese.
Yeah. Yeah. My friends who I introduced my mom to here, it was always a lot more than just jiao for sure. I mean, like, they're not little kids, but, you know, it would be jiao, jiao go. And then, you know, they would talk to her, right? They would ask her how she's doing, like, how was your trip? Khoe hong. And then they would like help her sit down. They would get her food. You know, my friends who are girls, like, they would like lock arms with her, walk with her. You know, they're just like, forget Chris, I'm here to hang out with you. You know, like, they give her so much attention because, like, they really love older folks here. They really do take care of older people. And like, my really mom was doing it. It was so cute because even at the airport, you know, we're flying Vietnam Airlines and, you know, they saw me with my mom and then they were like, oh, come over here. They put us in another line, you know, to like kind of cut everybody. And my mom was like, oh, nuk u thing, you know, like, we get nuk u thing, you know, and then she got in a lot of places. She just kept repeating that. And then she started like saying like, you know, she started expecting it, you know, I was like, oh, sao mai hong u thing, you know, like she felt like, really taken care of.
Yeah.
You know, I would be like,
I'd be like, Gong Tao, like, Chris Tran Travel is Tao the U thing.
They're like, who? Like, but it was cool, man. I didn't notice it until my mom started pointing it out that I was like, oh, yeah, you know, they really take care of older people here. It's a lot of respect still. Yeah. I love it.
Chris, thank you for agreeing always to sit and shoot the shit with me. These moments, these hours, are such a treat for me, because I know how really busy you are, and the work that you do is so valuable, and to be able to sit and really just kind of go everywhere with our topics is super, super duper valuable to me. And you know, being able to cut these up into clips, you know, of our conversation, and you know, being able to pick your brain and I want to say push and propel other people to kind of like suggest other topics and ways of thinking is a real treat in the work that I do. And I thank you so much for coming on today.
Bro, I'm always honored. And, you know, to me, this is like a teaser for me, because I would love to talk to you for days about any of this stuff. You know that. Yeah. So it's always such a pleasure, you know, to spend this time with you.
As long as we can always keep the role of me asking the questions and you talking about Vietnam, we're good. Yeah, it's a comfortable place for me to be. Don't be turning the tables on me, man. Don't be asking me a million questions.
I know how you feel.
This is great. And I hope to see you at the end of the year in Vietnam. And are you coming to LA anytime soon?
I will be there in a few months. I'll be back for a month in December.
A month?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's been a minute.
Why are you coming back for a month?
Just to visit family. And, you know, we're spread out. Most of my family are in Alabama.
Oh, wow.
That's where my mom lives. That's where my grandma lives. My sister, though, is in Redondo Beach, California. So, you know, we'll be split between those two. So we need that extra time.
Yeah, we should definitely set up a few podcasts when you get here and set up, you know, and just record.
Happy to.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Chris,
man. My pleasure.
Thank you so much. And we will be talking very soon.
All right. Catch you soon, Ken.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Take care, brother.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.